So again, Maxine, I'm so struck by, you know, as Joseph Smith is coming back in 1829, and, you know, this is when, like, all of this Isaiah, like, what's different, right? Like, I don't know that this is a different historical moment too, than it was the 9 months previous, year previous.
It is different. He's in a different place. And there are so many characteristics of the replacement text that are different from the Mosiah to Ether. I really loved Brent Metcalf's groundbreaking work on the priority of Mosiah in New Approaches to the Book of Mormon, where he talks about the differences and tracks the differences. But yeah, all of this Isaiah is happening in the replacement text. Not all of it, but I mean, a lot of it. There's some in 3rd Nephi, but yeah. And so Isaiah is becoming really important in this replacement text. And we don't know what was in the original lost pages, although Don Bradley has worked very hard to sleuth the clues in the replacement text to see what might have been in the lost pages. And he's written a book about what he thinks was in the lost pages based on historical critical analysis and clues and also textual clues. But yeah, I mean, I think you're raising a really interesting point, you know, why Isaiah becomes so important in the replacement text as foretelling. And then Nephi's great testimony, which is really important, is this parallel to Isaiah, because Isaiah is this old world prophet who sees as much as he sees. Nephi is this new world prophet who's picking up on what Isaiah said and taking it further for this new promised land, the American continent, and then seeing the whole panorama. And so Isaiah, I guess, is probably important because Nephi's role as sort of the American Isaiah is very dependent on Isaiah, very parallel, very linked into. He's like the counterpart, the parallel.
Can I say something about this?
Yeah. Oh, please jump in. Yeah, Adam, I want to hear from all of you.
Well, I think it's kind of interesting, especially since Nephi is saying, "Oh, I delight in plainness and everything," and yet, I have found that I've learned so much more about the messiness and complexity of Nephi by what he doesn't write. Because clearly, especially since, you know, included in this lesson is this Psalm of Nephi, this reflection over his life. Mm-hmm. And that guy's heartbroken.
Yeah.
All these things that he says he set out to do, this agenda that he has, that he wants his family and now his people to get, they are covenant people. And none of his children are around. The record and the inheritance of the prophetic role does not go to a child. It goes to his brother.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He is never complete with the murder he committed. His family is split up and warring each other. And I don't think he's ever quite complete with how he drove his siblings away. He never lets go of that sword. And I don't think he ever learns how to get that. No, his parents clearly weren't pleased with what happened when he returned with a bloody sword, a kidnapped servant, and a stolen book. You know, and so there are all these unwritten things that are implied in this torturous song that he has. He is trying to desperately to find peace, and he's battling the way he thought things should have been and the way they actually are. And to me, that's someone we can learn from, because that is our experience. We're constantly trying to find this simple meaning in our journeys, in our seeking, and it's not what we expected. It's not what we thought. And Isaiah, so much of really the power of Isaiah has to end up being not what is plainly said. We find our own meaning in it. We find our own self in it. And while I am constantly, you know, There are always the people who are going, oh, he's such a hero. He's so great. He did exactly what, you know, we're always doing horrible things and blaming God for it, or horrible things and blaming our siblings for it, or something. This is the example of Nephi for me right now. And if that, you know, isn't what we need to do as women, is to find ourselves in the unwritten things.
In the silences and spaces, Kim.
Yeah. It's a, for me, that's a, seeing these last words of Nephi, it's really a lesson in that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not this straightforward, plain, oh, look, he's so great and he's at, he's not.
Mm-hmm.
Before it at all. It's all the unwritten things that I learned from Nephi.
Mm-hmm. That's really profound. I like the way that you address the things he doesn't say, and the, you know, and his last sermon, you know, which we mentioned and talk about. The psalm, it's interesting, the psalm of Nephi, which comes earlier in 2 Nephi 4, is really an amazing, amazing text. I was wishing that I could deal with that in this lesson, but that was the previous lesson in 2 Nephi 4, so it didn't fall into this section. But the psalm of Nephi is so profound. I used that text when I came back to the church and spoke up there in 2012. I quoted from the Psalm of Nephi, and it's just one of the most beautiful texts in the Book of Mormon. But yeah, I love what you're saying about the silences and what they're telling us.
So I got to teach that one 2 weeks ago, Maxine. I got to use the Psalm of Nephi.
I didn't get to hear yours.
But and so it's hard. It's so this is going to sound contrary, but I very much agree with you and Jody talking about gleaning from the scriptures the profound insights that move me as an individual, that make the little. I appreciate you saying that that's the rare, not the every verse or every chapter, because my, call it contrarian, I do resist the read that we move to either Zion in heaven or Zion in our hearts, because I think both the Bible, especially the Old Testament, and the Book of Mormon are incredibly tribal, incredibly socio-political, economic, how do we make Zion on this earth, and mostly a narrative of failure. I mean, even to Christ comes and that isn't even enough. I mean, that's good for four generations, but even that didn't do it. So I just resist moving away from the idea that we are really wrestling with it, whether it's Nephi or Joseph Smith or Mormon or whoever is telling this story, that what they are really working on is how do we make society work? How do we make us work together? And I mean, we want the scriptures to be a story of success. We want them to be a teaching, but I think they are mostly not. They're mostly a story of what didn't work. And so I don't want to move too quickly into the Zion in my heart or Zion in the hereafter. I think we miss something if we move quickly, that if we move too quickly, because these people, I mean, whoever's telling the story from chapter to chapter, book to book, is really wrestling with that very problem. How do we work together? And how do we make this work when we have warring tribes, when we have families broken up? And I don't want to let go of that struggle. That is the struggle of this life.
Wow, that is so profound. And I'm really glad that you pinpointed that. And I hope I didn't imply that I thought the inner Zion was where it really happened, and it never happens, socially. Because what I was trying to say is that it's both simultaneous, and God is working with both. But yeah, I mean, that's why I posed the question at the end. When we look back and we evaluate you know, our struggle to do this, to create Zion and live in that radically inclusive vision in Second Nephi and Isaiah and Galatians. Well, where do we fail? How are we failing? You know, and so it's, I think that we have to be constantly evaluating that. That's what a lot of the critique of the church is right now, online and in our own lives. We're critiquing where we failed. And some of us are also constantly trying to say, but hey, but we're succeeding over here and over here and right there. There are these moments and examples. And I'm always trying to address both in everything I do. I'm addressing where we succeeded and where they succeeded, where Joseph and Emma succeeded, where the Book of Mormon succeeded, and where it failed. You know, and I just think it's important. I think all we can do is be conscious and aware of both and be addressing both, doing the shadow work and the light work and addressing both. As I, you know, Jung said, that's the best we can do. We don't make ourselves perfect. We make the shadow conscious, you know?
Yeah. So I think that's what I got from Maxine. I didn't see kind of this dichotomy. So that Chris is kind of coming to it with. And I think like that, that like recognizing where, like we see a model of that and yeah. that we set up, like here's, you know, chapter 26 and like, here's what Zion, you know, actually looks like in the flesh. Right. Yeah. And then like Jody's brought out that, you know, then we get this lament where Nephi himself is reflecting on like how everything, you know, went wrong. And I think that's, you know, maybe we can take that as a model then for actually grappling with our mistakes and with like how we have fallen short in reaching kind of this our goals and what we know to be, you know, the center of the gospel of Christ.
I would love to piggyback on that. Like, this all just strikes me as a discussion of how hard it is to be human. I mean, that's what these chapters do. It is so hard to be human. And in part of that, I've come to believe is that we're, in order to try to get through what is so hard in life, we're fighting our biology. Our biology is wired for survival. It's wired for defense, for protection. Or, you know, and it's hard. It's hard for us to get outside ourselves. We can do a pretty good job with the people really close to us that we know really well. And then we try to put up the defenses around them, right? And that it's biological. And so we're in this constant wrestle of accepting the imperfection of what life is, which is really hard to do without just putting up all the walls. But there's something in this idea of Zion, and I do think it's inner and outer. As we can get to a place, in it takes going inward to create that Zion, so that we can be open-hearted enough to do it in our larger and larger and larger groups. And I really see the scriptures, you know, in terms of adult development, in terms of that being our progression. If we choose to accept it through life, is widening those, of learning how to manage what defenses we really need internally so that we don't have to be putting up the walls. So how do we progress and include more and more and trust enough in our own goodness and in the people around us to have our backs so that we can draw those lines larger and larger and larger? It starts in here, but we need to express it out here. It's not just about being holy in here. It's about taking that to the world. So but it's hard. And I see the scriptures in exactly that way. They are cautionary tales. They are showing us how we always fail at this. But it's also not about punishing ourselves for all of the mistakes in that. It's allowing ourselves to be human. And that's the essence of atonement, the essence of being at one with the divinity that allows us to be larger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, having both the courage and the humility to deal with all of it, to deal with the whole person, to deal with the really hard stuff, the stuff we don't want to deal with, then the failures and the fears, and at the same time deal with the really good stuff. And I really appreciate Chris's pragmatic reminder and focus coming from his own long, hard journey and work of, you know, we can't just be Gnostics who go and isolate ourselves away from the world. That's one of the reasons I had to come back to the LDS Church. You know, the Gnostics, we were isolated. You know, we've got to live in society and community and deal with the messiness and deal with each other and be part of something, even though it's going to be hard and it's going to hurt us. And that's why I came back to the church. I mean, that's the message I got. You need to go back and learn how to belong and really, really, really be part of something instead of being isolated off in your nice little chapel all by yourself. And so Chris's, you know, reminder of that we really are very much affecting each other, and we need to evaluate that, and we need to see where we're hurting each other, and we need to speak to that, and we need to be there for each other. We need to be, like Jen is pointing out, we need to be both courageous and humble. We need to speak to the harm, you know, and also speak to the grace that we're seeking. And I love how Jody talks about Nephi lamenting his own failures. That's such a poignant part of what he's giving us.
So this might be personal, Maxine. You could take it personally if you want to. We know their words. Sometimes we use the white and delightsome that are awful to deal with or hard to deal with. But for me, there are several places in 2 Nephi that use the terms cut off from the people, or cut off, and they put them in God's voice. God will cut them off. But that the cutting off has always been the most painful words in 2 Nephi. Can you think about those? Can we think about those as wrong, as incorrect, as false? The cutting off is just, I guess I want to say that. I want to say that a whole idea of cutting off is just a false premise. It's something Nephi got wrong.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. I mean, I find that same idea and sentiment in the Old Testament, in Gnostic texts, in the Doctrine and Covenants, in the Book of Mormon. I find it a lot, and not, you find this exclusion and invalidation and condemnation of other people so much in Gnostic texts as well. And yeah, those are the moments when I'm reading the text and thinking, whoa, this person's fears and biases and racism and sexism is really showing up here. And yeah, I mean, though, that language, and what you're getting at is that the writers of these scriptures, the scribes who are writing down their revelations, they're attributing everything that they're receiving, the grace and the biases, to God. They're basically saying, you know, this is God who is condemning people and telling people, you'll be destroyed unless you come to Christ, and you'll be cut off unless you are converted to Christ. And I just have to say that those are the moments in scripture when the scribe, the receiver, the prophet, the seer, is attributing their own biases to God. I mean, I think, you know, what's interesting is that Joseph Smith said, you know, I or any other leader could lead the church astray. It's really important for people to read the scriptures with the Spirit and discern which parts are spiritually true and which ones aren't. And, you know, that was a hermeneutic that he proposed and that he was trying to use himself, but he, I think, failed many times and erred in many ways. And so I think we have to read all scripture with the spirit of discernment to discern which parts are divine voice speaking and which parts are the scribe speaking. And attributing what they are receiving to God, which I consider, and absolutely I consider, an error.
It is, if you put it in human terms, anybody who's going to try to create a city of God, a Zion, a community is going to have to wrestle with the troublemaker, with there may be somebody among us who needs to be kicked out. And we never want to do that, but I think that over and over again, history tells us that you have to deal with that question. You have to deal with that problem in human society. So I understand it, but as you say, Maxine, I've been looking at Jody as I said, Maxine, the attributing it to God is a problem, but I think I think we still have to deal with the question, are there cases where God has to cut someone off? Is heaven for everybody? And that's the universalist question. That's the challenge. And I just, again, like I said earlier, I don't want to let go of that question too quickly. I mean, because I don't like the question, because I don't like the consequences. I think it's one we have to keep thinking about, keep struggling with.
Well, and along that line, I think, as we mentioned, the things that we do and then we blame it on God is a real problem, because I think it's the worst way to take the name of God in vain is we attribute things, a narrowness and a smallness and a failure to God that we need to own. And it is only in the ownership of it that we can actually notice something and approach transformation. Because until did Nephi ever realize, oh my gosh, that I really blew it, and I laid out a path that is going to cause massive destruction by saying God justified me murdering someone that I was really pissed off at. It horrifies me to think of all of the justifications for violence. And it's the same type of thing with cutting off. To attribute any kind of cutting off or elimination or denial of existence to God is really a dangerous precedent to do. I mean, look at what's happening in legislatures and in governments and in the church. By claiming the ability to say that God will not allow this person to exist. And so the horrible things that happen, and one of the few ways that we can really truly heal as an individual or as a people is to own them, is to get, this is me not allowing someone to exist. And I think one of the great images in the Book of Mormon narrative is when Christ comes and one by one invites people to come to him, one by one. And this image that this really is how God sees us, one by one. Nobody is tonight. Nobody is not seeing their existence in this being of divinity. And yet, how can we learn to approach God except in our relationships, except in community, except in being around and wrestling with what it is to be in this messiness of humanity, these failures, these tragedies, these glorious redemptions that we offer each other? It's really an amazing, the contrariness of it, the opposition of it occurring, that here's this amazing image of one by one, and yet the entire narrative is about it only happens when we learn how to be related to each other. Can we really learn how to approach God and be seen as an individual?
Yeah, I agree with Jody that for me, the nature of God is not to cut off. I believe that is part of our being human. It's part of our instinct, because we want what is simple. We want what is plain, right? We want that so desperately, and yet it is not the nature of reality. And you know, at the Living School, we talked about retributive justice versus restorative justice, that restorative justice is more the nature of God, that all things can be redeemed, all things can be restored. And when we have difficulties, when we see people that we reinterpret as meaning us harm, we want to control that, cut off, defend, without seeing with God's lens that sees all people as redeemable. It's not what's wrong with you. It's what happened to you. And how do we redeem us? And the truth is that as humans, we feel like our lives are too busy and too difficult, which is true, but we really don't want to do what we need to do to help and support people to be redeemed that we see as dangerous. And we don't want to do the work to try to redeem ourselves and to see what is there. So I think that's why the way is straight and then gate is narrow, because it is so hard and requires so much of us to pull together and to help those people that we are, our hearts are wanting to cut off. But that's why we have to really dig into our godly nature to pull something even deeper out to help those who we want, what our instincts are to cut off.
So you just condemned me, Jana.
I'm here for it. You wanted myself to impress.
Jana, we're friends. Where this is not. But in my life in the church, unfortunately, I have come across people whom I felt could not tolerate them as part of the community. And that may be, you know, we're living in time but there were problems, there were abuses that took advantage of community and of trust that meant to me, you just cannot be part of this community. And I'm sorry, that's my limited view. That's the failings of this world, maybe, but it ain't easy. But
yeah. So, and it's not that we don't have boundaries. We need boundaries. We do need to protect ourselves. I don't want to throw that out. That's part of the work. It's how do we do that? How do we do both? How do we dig deep, have the boundaries that we need to protect? And how do we pool our resources to see what we can do for somebody?
And not think that just because we need to have boundaries for our safety or where we're at any given moment, and not assume that that means God has cut them off.
That's right.
You know?
So, I mean, you know, just coming back to this 2 Nephi 26, you know, it's just so clear about, you know, who the source of darkness is, and that God worketh not in darkness. He doesn't tell anyone, cut anyone off. You know, he doesn't say, depart from me to anyone. Everyone is welcome to come. Everyone is welcome to partake of salvation. It's free for all. And I'm just so struck again by this just very clear articulation that God loves the world, the whole world. Yeah.
And I think I like the way Jody articulated the balance too. And I'm glad you went back and picked that up again, Rebecca, also, because there was so much more in that text I was trying to trim and I didn't quote the whole thing. And I love that you've just included part that I didn't include in the quote. But that balance of there are times when it doesn't work socially to work with people. Sometimes we can't work together. But that doesn't mean that God isn't still working with all of us. I shared that idea when I spoke at Sunstone, talking about September 6th and how we were cut off and each of us went off on a different path and how God continued to work with all of us. And the church and I both needed a break from each other. I needed a break from the church for 20 years and they needed a break from me, you know, really, we did. I was just not having it and confrontational and angry and they couldn't deal with me. And that break was wonderful. That 20-year break was wonderful. Like God kept working with me and leading me, and God kept leading Levina and Mike and the Toscanos and Abraham and Lynn and and Brent and David and everybody else, Janice and Margaret, you know, every person who's cut off, God continues to work with them and lead them on their path. Even though we can't always get along, we can't always work together. This is the struggle. You know, Chris is identifying the struggle that we see all through the Book of Mormon and the Doctrine and Covenants and in LDS Origins and in the church today. I mean, this is where we're at, and this is where we're at in America politically. You know, we are struggling with how do we work together when we really can't work together? And then how is God dealing with all of this? Because God is leading all of this, but how can we somehow work any of this out?
Amen.
The struggle.
We're now at 11:40. It's been such a fun, rich discussion. Thank you to everybody.
Greetings. My name is Rebecca DeSchweinitz, and I'm thrilled to serve as a board member at the Dialogue Foundation and as one of the hosts of Dialogue Gospel Study. In each episode, which we record live the second and fourth Sunday of every month, we welcome esteemed speakers from a variety of backgrounds to share their insights and perspectives on the Come Follow Me lessons. Our aim is to spark meaningful conversations about the scriptures, to connect them to our personal experiences and to our understandings and explorations of the gospel. To stay in the loop with our upcoming lessons and this opportunity to engage with Mormon thought, culture, and belief, be sure to visit dialoguejournal.com and sign up for our newsletter. By doing so, you'll receive updates and timely links to join our live stream lessons. Additionally, you can catch up on our past guests and episodes by subscribing to Dialogue Journal on YouTube, Facebook, or wherever you listen to podcasts.